The first long-distance television pictures of Air France Flight 358 showed the Airbus broken and burning off the end of the runway in Toronto. The plane billowed smoke amid rain-soaked trees down a sharp ravine, and it seemed impossible to believe that many could have escaped with their lives. Within a few hours, a very different picture emerged. Passengers had scrambled to safety down the slides, heroic flight attendants, cars that pulled over to help, 309 passengers and crew, every one survived. There were injuries, but none is believed to be life-threatening. We've all sat through those interminable safety spiels that begin every flight. Maybe you dutifully follow along, learning how to buckle your seatbelt again. Maybe you flip through the laminated instructions or stay focused on your mystery novel. But who really expects that you'll actually have to use those oxygen masks and inflated slides or float to safety on your seat cushion in the unlikely event of a water landing? Well, today we'll go revisit the crash of Flight 358 from a passenger's point of view. We'll also talk with a man being called a hero for his part in the rescue effort, and we'll bring you an update on the investigation into the crash. Later in the hour, we'll continue our Summer Movie Awards series with your recommendations for Best Teen Movie. We haven't sealed the envelope yet. You can still sneak in a submission, TOTN@NPR.org. But first, the anatomy of a plane crash. We especially want to hear from airline professionals in the audience, flight attendants, pilots, air traffic controllers, emergency crew. Have you gone through a crisis? How well prepared were you? And if you were a passenger in a plane crash, we want to hear your story as well. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN@NPR.org. And we begin with Caroline Deason. She was a passenger on Tuesday's Air France flight, and she's with us now from her home in London, Ontario. And it's very good of you to be with us on Talk of the Nation. I know it's been a very busy couple of days.
Thanks very much, Neil. It's a pleasure to be talking to you about it. I'm glad I can talk to anyone about it, really.
I bet you are. Tell us what was happening. When did you notice first that you were flying into a storm?
Well, almost instantaneously, as soon as I could see that we were over Toronto, I knew that we were going through very thick cloud and everything. And I kind of, I'm obviously not a pilot, and I knew our descent was really fast, just to, comparative to other descents I've been on in different flights. But never did I think that it was going to end up how it did.
And as I understand it, there was one attempt at a landing, and then the plane went around again.
That's true. We circled for about 20 minutes before we took another attempt at it.
And when the plane eventually did touch down, I understand a lot of the passengers broke out in applause.
Yes, we all applauded, actually. Most of the European flights that I've been on, we applaud when we get down. It wasn't particularly that. I didn't feel panicked or anything during the landing. When we touched down, I did feel like we were going really quickly, but I figured it was just maybe because I knew the runway was very slick and that it was raining at that point. But then there were some bumps, and the bumps just got faster and more violent, and at that point, almost instantaneously, we came to a really sudden stop, which must have been the impact. The lights went out and the oxygen mask came down, and I looked out my window and there was just a big orange cloud of flame, really.
And what did you think at that moment?
I thought, well, this is serious and I'm getting out of here. So I don't even remember jumping up and running to the exit. I just knew that within a matter of seconds I was there. And I saw that the flight attendant was already opening the door and that the slide was being deployed. The pilot came over the intercom and he said, the worst is over and that we're safe now. Everybody remain calm. So I believed him and I went back to get my backpack because it had my passport in it. So I went back and got my backpack and ran back to the exit and I went down the slide. And only at that moment did I realize that the plane had actually crashed. Because up until then, I thought that maybe we just came to a very sudden stop and that there was something wrong and that I had even imagined the flames. So we just had to run up this hill and we ran all the way to the highway and I never looked back until we were in the safety of the coach and then I realized really what could have happened.
Where were you seated in an aisle or a middle seat?
I was actually on the left side right at the window at the rear of the plane. So I was one of the first to evacuate.
Because there was a door nearby?
Exactly.
And people have talked about just how good the flight attendants were.
They were amazing. I 100% believe that the only reason all of us evacuated is because of the crew and because of the police response. By the time I got up to the highway, it must have only been 3 minutes that it took for me to run from the plane to the highway. There were already fire trucks spraying on the fire, and I knew that it was because of the crew and the police officers that were already there and the fire the fire officers that's why we all survived.
How did the other passengers react? I mean, if you were at a window seat, there must have been a couple of people between you and the aisle.
It's true. There was one man next to me. He was an absolute angel. And because I was by myself on the plane, I was flying home after a month in Europe by myself, and I was just kind of ready to go home.
Mm-hmm.
And when we had to escape, he held my hand the whole time, and we ran through everything together just to make sure that, you know, each other were safe. But I didn't feel a lot of panic while I was on the plane. Everybody, I didn't even feel scared, and I don't think many other people felt scared because you couldn't even think. You just knew that you had to get out of there, and that was your number one priority.
You mentioned going down the slide, the inflatable side. Some of them didn't work. What about yours?
Mine worked, thankfully. I think, I'm not sure exactly, but I think there was only one exit that was working, and I was basically, I was on the left side of the plane across from the exit,
mm-hmm.
so I only had to walk down a couple seats and over to the right side of the plane, and I was out. I was very lucky.
And the lights went out, you said, but there are supposed to be emergency lights. Did those work?
There were hazard lights. They were orange.
Uh-huh.
They came on. But that is just so, it's like a montage in my head. I just see these images of us bumping and the oxygen masks and then the flame. So you're in this mode that you have to get out of there as quickly as possible. I didn't even realize, I didn't take note that any of the overhead compartments were opening or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. When you finally got to the ground, was there somebody there to say, keep running, keep going this way?
Yeah, we were directed up the hill, and I have no idea who it was that directed us up the hill, just because I didn't think to look at their name tag or anything. I just followed the mass, and then we were ushered into an empty transport truck,
mm-hmm.
and we all stayed there for a long time, but we were very close to the wreck at this point. We were all pretty nervous because I guess they needed police clearance to drive us off,
mm-hmm.
and we could smell the smoke from where we were, so we evacuated from the transport truck as well. And
because you were afraid the plane was going to explode.
Exactly. And that was the worst. That was the worst part for me, because that's when I started to be scared, because I thought, how bad would it be if I survived a plane crash and then died in a blast afterwards? You know, that would just be the worst way to die. So we ran down the highway, and the police crew were cleaning all this debris out of the way. There was barbed wire and everything so that we could get to these coaches that they had stopped. They put us in these highway coaches, and they took us about a kilometer away from the crash, until they figured out that everybody was off the plane, and then they drove us to the terminal.
Hmm. I assume your family and friends knew that you were on that particular plane?
Yes, they did. That was the worst part, really. When I had ran up to the top, to the highway, and I got in that transport truck, I realized that everyone's going to find out about the crash before they find out that I'm okay.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when it really hit me. That's when I broke down and I started crying. Because up until then, like I said, I wasn't really scared at all. I was just in this survival mode. But that's when I realized that, you know, back home, it's just going to be horrendous for them to think that. And it was about an hour before I got to talk to them.
So you didn't have a cell phone in that backpack that you rescued?
No, actually. And I lost everything. My cell phone was in my luggage, and my luggage is gone. The saxophone that I was playing on tour in Europe is gone. And even the backpack that I saved was torn open, I think, while I was running up the hill. I think just someone grabbed it for support, and everything in my backpack also fell out, so it was kind of a lost cause to get my backpack.
I wonder, you talked about getting scared in that truck later. A few hours later, I wonder if you didn't get the shakes.
I did, because also, we were drenched. It was raining. We were all in shock. When we were in the terminal, it was nice for me to see that everyone was out safe and that all these families were sitting together, but again, I was by myself. I called my mom a couple times, and I didn't even really have anything to say. I just liked hearing your voice, and
mm-hmm.
I did get, you know, I was just as traumatized then as I was when I was in the actual event itself, but it was good to know that I was safe at that point.
Carolyn Deason, thank you so much for sharing your story. I'm sure you're going to get another saxophone.
I hope so.
Okay, maybe a better one.
For letting me tell my story. I'm glad that all of us can tell our stories, and it's something to celebrate, really.
Thanks again. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
As Caroline sat inside that darkened plane, Guy Ledet, a manager for the airport's budget rent-a-car office, was watching it careen off the runway. He joins us now from his home in Brampton, Ontario, and it's very good of you to join us today on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
When did you notice the plane was in trouble?
Well, I was actually driving parallel to the plane on a road, a public access road in the airport, and I just happened to be watching it. As you know, we drive into the airport, and we always just seem to watch the planes as they land and take off while we're driving in. and I was, the weather was really bad. It was raining hard. And I was just thinking to myself, wow, that plane's out in this weather. And I was just sort of watching the road, watching the plane. It wasn't really taking off, because I actually thought it was taking off, so I didn't know what it was doing. Just kept going and going. And I was watching it. There was lightning strikes around, and all of a sudden, lightning hit the plane off in the distance. And then there was some smoke, and it just continued on and just disappeared right down the hill from my view.
So what did you do?
Well, I was just like, oh, my God, it hit by lightning. And it was just sort of, I was behind about three or four cars. And after it went down, like about, 30 seconds later, we're just turning the curve where the plane went down, and everybody was stopping. There was smoke, and people were trying to reverse, get out of the way. I just started zigzagging around these people on the curve in the opposite lane, and finally got over to where the plane had broken through the fence and the concrete to go through the gully. And I just sort of parked in there and looked and saw the tail section sticking up, a little bit of fire, and I was like, oh, my God. So I just opened my door, and I was just looking at it for a few seconds, and I just got my camera, my phone out, and took a couple of pictures with my phone camera phone.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just quickly called work and said a plane had crashed, and I got to go help them. And they were just like, what? I just threw my phone in the car, shut the door, and just ran across the field, because I saw a few people, three or four people actually coming out from the edge.
Mm-hmm.
Elliot went in and just running along the fence away from it. So I just ran to that spot, and I looked down, and there's just a mess of people down there, and there's just a stream of people coming from where the plane was, heading towards this spot to climb up the hill, and people having a hard time because it's like pouring rain. The grass is all matted down. People are sliding down. I just jumped in a little bit down and just started offering my arms and pulling people up as much as I could.
We have to take a short break. Can you stay with us?
Yes, I can.
All right, we're going to take a short break, and we'll hear the rest of Guy Ledet's story. It's pretty dramatic stuff, and stay with us. We want to hear from those of you who have been involved with air crashes, whether you're flight attendant, pilot, air traffic controller. Give us a call. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, TOTN@npr.org. Back after the break. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The crash of Air France Flight 358 at Toronto's Pearson International Airport Tuesday and the survival of everyone aboard raises questions about what conditions bring planes down, how passengers and crew can best deal with an emergency. If you've had such an experience as a pilot, flight attendant, air traffic controller, or passenger, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, TOTN@npr.org. We're talking now with Guy Ledet, a manager for budget rent-a-car at Pearson Airport. And Guy, as we left your story, you were going down into the ravine and helping pull up passengers who were fleeing the airplane, but then you went to the plane itself.
Yes, I was like, well, I was actually went halfway down. I just started pulling people up. And halfway through that, I noticed another gentleman, I don't know where he came from, I guess another passerby like me, was doing the same thing. We were just doing that, and then I could see that it was just ending. There wasn't that many people left. I'm asking, anybody left on the plane? Is there anybody left on the plane? And people didn't know. They really couldn't see anybody. They didn't know. So after we got the last person up, I just bolted down the embankment and started running towards the plane, and the other gentleman was right behind me. And we got around the corner to the back of the plane, or the tail section, and there was one of the inflatable ramps going up.
Mm-hmm.
And I just ran up to it and jumped on it, but I sort of slid down, and I just had to grab onto the little rungs or stubs that are on the side of it and just sort of actually pull myself right up to the door.
Let me put this in. You crawled up into a burning plane.
Yes. I wasn't even thinking the whole time. I didn't have a thought in my mind. It's just go do it. And we both got up into the plane after a couple of minutes just pulling ourselves up. And we just got in. There was two aisles. He took the left, I took the right, and we just started going up the plane, calling out, looking in the seats, calling out. We were just moving a little quickly, and as I was looking, I could see flames on the outside windows. And we just went through quickly, checked the cockpit. There was nobody in there. And we went up to the exit on the right, and there was no inflatable ramp, so he jumped out. And as soon as he jumped out, there was a big explosion in the back, and the whole plane shook, and I just sort of woke up to the reality of actually what position I was in. And I just went, oh, my God, I have to get out, and I just sort of ran and jumped at the same time.
Were you hurt at all?
No, I mean, I just, I just had sore legs and a sore back later from all the exerting and that. But, I mean, we just went around to the front of the plane, and right when we turned around to go to the nose of the plane near the creek, the pilot and the co-pilot, I guess, that was them, and a few passengers just happened to be there. So I guess they had just exited the plane before we got onto it. They were just still at the front of the plane.
I wonder, after the adrenaline rush had passed, what do you think about what you did?
Well, I was just sort of numb. I mean, when I actually, followed out the trail, all the passengers would take to go into the highway, and I bolted up the side of the embankment to go up to the airport property, climbed a fence, and then went to a field and climbed another barbed wire fence just to let them know that these people were under the highway, and I noticed that they were climbing up into the middle of the highway. And the police officer took me back to the vehicle I had abandoned in the middle of the whole scene. I just couldn't talk. I was just, like, shaking, and the officer was just asking me if I had any ID, and I just checked with my wallet. I just handed him my wallet. He could take my information out of that. I couldn't even talk. Just too shaken. I just couldn't believe what I'd actually done. I didn't think, I could actually do something like that.
It's going to be nice to have a nice, normal day at work again, isn't it?
Well, yeah. If a nice, normal life would be nice. I've had like 6 hours sleep in the last 2 days. So.
Well, get some rest, Guy.
Yes.
Thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Guy Lede is a manager for Budget Rent-A-Car, and he joined us from his home in Brampton, Ontario. Let's get a caller on the line, 800-989-8255. And this is Bill. Bill calling from Phoenix, Arizona.
Yeah, how you doing? To follow up on what he just said, a normal day for that gentleman. Well, I'm a captain for an airline in the U.S. system, and basically, I commend the crew definitely for being able to do their job so quickly, efficiently, and professionally. But I think this kind of brings to point where people need to start focusing on what's going on in our lives as crew members. Work rules, 16 hours of duty day, continuous duty, continued reduced rest on our overnights, sleeping in airplanes and in terminals for like 3 hours. That's our normal day. I'll take your comments offline.
Thanks very much for the call, Bill. I'm not sure that I have any comments on that. It's not my place to comment on them. Joining us now is Melissa Madden, safety chairperson for United Airlines Association of Flight Attendants, herself a veteran flight attendant. She's with us from her office in Chicago. Thanks very much for being with us.
No problem, Guy. How are you today?
It's not Guy. It's Neil.
Neil.
Guy was the heroic man in Ontario.
The one that actually climbed into the airplane.
Yes, indeed.
That was amazing. We don't normally advocate for civilians to climb inside a burning aircraft, but that was an amazing story.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, Neil.
I wondered what you made of the pilot we just heard from who talked about the conditions that, flight attendants, pilots, all kinds of crew operate under.
Well, flight attendants are certified onboard safety professionals, and we're trained to get passengers off the aircraft as quickly as possible. Regarding longer duty days and extra legs, I think he does have a good point there, but nonetheless, we are trained safety professionals, and when the time comes to evacuate an aircraft, we would expect that our flight attendants would be able to do that.
90 seconds seems like how possibly did they get 309 people off a plane in 90 seconds?
90 seconds, that's exactly what they expect us to get people out in. And I think that because of the fact that the crews are so well trained and they give very specific and precise commands, they're trained to accommodate passengers who might be in negative panic. They know exactly how to assess conditions. They are very good at responding to exits that may be blocked or may be on fire or slide malfunctions. That's what we do. We practice this. We train this all the time. And once it starts, we just start moving those passengers out as quickly as possible. But you're correct. 90 seconds is not a lot of time to get 300 people out of an airplane.
You train for it all the time, but you can't train with the adrenaline and the smoke and the fire and the panic.
You're absolutely right, and as much as we'd like to duplicate the real-world scenario, our training conditions are artificial. Generally, we have cooperative passengers. We'll have no fire, no smoke, and you're right. We don't get to train in those scenarios, and we actually advocate for more realistic training.
Hmm.
But the adrenaline, I just believe that just kicks in. We are so well-trained, and this is so much of who we are and what we do and why we're on board that once we start to do that, we actually go into almost an auto mode.
Let's get another caller on the line. Now, this is Bob. Bob calling from Little River in South Carolina.
Yeah, hi.
How are you?
Oh, I'm fine. I don't have anything to say about this particular accident, but being an air traffic controller for 37 years, 17 of which was the manager of Washington Dulles International Airport, I have one story that you might find interesting, and that was the fact that while I was a controller at the National Airport in Washington, now called Reagan Airport, I noticed an Eastern Constellation taxiing out, and just before he took off, his engine started smoking quite a bit, so I notified the pilot and cautioned him, and I guess the caution caused him to lift off after takeoff, and instead of proceeding on course, he made a sharp left turn around the airport, and he noticed that there was a fire on board one of the engines, and he asked for an emergency landing, so I brought him on in and cleared all the other aircraft out of the way and so forth, and the fire people from the airport followed him down the runway on a run and sprayed his wing, and so happened that my wife, before I met her, was on that plane, and I didn't realize that until 3 years later, after we had our first child. Well, I was telling her about this because there was an incident similar to this up in Kennedy Airport, and I was telling her about this incident I had in Washington, and she said, "Well, honey, I was on that plane." She slid off. They got her off the plane and brought her over to the terminal building, and we kept the aircraft out on the runway. In the meantime, the fire people from the airport did a wonderful job and got the engine out, and everybody was just fine.
That's amazing coincidence.
I will say that the crew, apparently on this particular flight in Ontario, I guess it was,
yes,
did a great job in getting those people moving.
No doubt about that. Yeah. Thanks for the call, Bob. Appreciate it. That's a great story.
Okay, thanks.
Melissa Madden, talking about a constellation, tells us how long ago that was. Since those days, there have been a lot of changes to the interior of aircraft, the materials that the aircraft is built out of, and the seats are much less flammable than it used to be, for example.
Yeah, absolutely, Neil. I think that safety within the aircraft itself, as far as less flammable materials and more slides or better slides and better wind conditions, I think all of those safety improvements have added to the safety of air travel itself. Nonetheless, I think the key is always going to be the flight attendants and the fact that they're there and responding to the situation. You can have the best equipment in the world, but if it fails or without any direction, I think that safety is compromised at that point in time, and I think that's why we're on board. Hmm. You know, and I would kind of like to go back to that caller from Phoenix about the long duty days. One of the issues that has come up is fatigue, and we have to wonder whether or not that would delay the reactions of the crew, these long duty days and fatiguing work schedules. And one of the things that we need to do is respond almost immediately and instinctively, and that's why we are actually concerned about fatigue.
Melissa Madden, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thanks very much.
Melissa Madden, safety chairperson for the United Airlines Association of Flight Attendants. She worked as a flight attendant for 30 years herself, and she joined us from her office in Chicago. Let's go now to Toronto's Pearson International Airport, where Kevin McGran, a transportation reporter for the Toronto Star, joins us. Thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
I know you just left a press conference held by Canada's Transportation Safety Board. What's the news?
Well, there's actually bad news to start things off. They're very disappointed right now because the flight data recorder and the cockpit voice recorder, it turns out Canada doesn't have the technology to download the information on those recorders. So now they're about 3 days behind schedule already because they can't do much at the plane until they get that information. So those two black boxes are being sent as we speak right now to France, where French authorities will download the information and send it back to Canada, and that whole process is going to take about 3 days.
So, indeed, disappointing. I know that there's been a lot of speculation about the cause of the crash, whether it was the weather, the lightning, wind shear. What did they say?
Well, I mean, they say that accidents never happen because of one thing alone. I mean, sort of the leading theory that's going around with experts on the outside looking in is that perhaps the pilot, knowing that there was bad weather, thunderstorms, wind shears, what have you, they tend to speed up on for their landing for that reason. And maybe when he touched down, maybe he touched down too far up the runway and couldn't stop in time. Maybe there is some hydraulic effect with so much rain having fallen. About 8 millimeters of rain was in the midst of falling at that point anyway. Maybe there is a problem with the brakes. I'm hearing now from some plane spotters that it looks to them like the spoilers didn't deploy, and they helped the brakes slow down.
Those are slots on the wing that help the plane brake. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. So it could be that the pilot made a wrong decision to speed up, or he had no decision but to speed up, and something on the plane gave out, and something with the weather gave out all at the same time. So it's probably going to end up being a combination of at least three or four different factors.
We're talking with reporter Kevin McGran of the Toronto Star. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Kevin, tell us, when Flight 358 touched down, the airport was under what's known as a red alert because of the lightning. Are planes allowed to land under such conditions?
It's basically up to the pilot. The pilot had clearance to land from Nav Canada, which is our air traffic control system up here. But Nav Canada says all they really do is they tell the pilot, there's no planes in front of you, you can land if you want. And it's really up to the pilot at that point to make the call whether to land or to keep circling or to go off somewhere else. Up to that point, planes had been landing. What the red alert ends up doing is it keeps everybody on the plane because the ground crews can't come out because of the lightning to service the planes and to marshal it in and to get the luggage off, so everybody has to stay on the plane. So they say normally it's not a problem to land during a thunderstorm. Obviously, this time it appears it was.
Yeah. Do we know if the plane had enough fuel to go on to Montreal or wherever?
Well, they most likely did. They generally have enough fuel to get to their next nearest safest location to land. In fact, right after this plane crashed, a KLM flight was supposed to come in, and they closed the airport down so that the emergency crews could get there without interfering with plane traffic. And a KLM flight had to move on to Syracuse because it didn't have enough fuel to keep circling. So they do have some reserves. This one probably did. Certainly with the explosions and the fire, the fuel was there burning, and it added to the fire, obviously. So there was fuel in the tank.
I understand the pilot himself is in a hospital with back problems, and they've not spoken with him as yet.
They've not spoken to the lead investigator, Riel Levasseur, says he doesn't want to speak to him if he's in pain, as he wants him, his mind at the ready to remember everything. He doesn't want to disturb him if he's in pain. But they're not telling us exactly the extent of the injuries. We actually know very little about the pilot. I don't think we know his name yet.
Have they spoken with the co-pilot, with the flight attendants?
They spoke with the co-pilot today. They're not telling us what he said. They're not telling us what they asked. They say you can guess what we ask because it's probably obvious, but that information is privileged under our Transportation Safety Board Act. They're not required to inform anybody of that until they release their final findings, which could take up to a year or so. After the co-pilot, it's going to be the pursers and the flight attendants, and they'll get to the captain when the captain is ready to speak to them.
And we know the captain is still in the hospital. How many other people injured are still being treated in the hospital?
There's a total of 14 people that were still in hospital as of this morning. None of them are life-threatening injuries. It's mostly, I think, the severest is probably there might be some smoke inhalation, there might be some broken limbs, that sort of thing.
And one other question. We've all heard a lot about the remarkable efficiency and heroism. I think that's not too strong a word about the flight crew and particularly the flight attendants. Emergency crews at Pearson, they also responded very quickly.
Yeah, the first fire crew was there within 52 seconds. The plane was evacuated within 2 minutes. And the plane caught fire, exploded basically a minute or two after that. So, I mean, planes are designed for passengers to disembark within 90 seconds in case of emergency. It seems to have happened in this case, just in the nick of time, but it's still a well-thought-out plan that worked well.
And by the narrowest of eyelashes, but it did seem that, everybody's all right.
Everybody's all right. It's most remarkable. I saw the plane yesterday. I was maybe 500 feet from it, and to think that people survived, it's really quite something. And the only people that got hurt, nobody was hurt in the way the plane crashed. They all were hurt disembarking, going down the chutes, and in a couple of cases, the chutes didn't deploy, which is a concern for the safety board people, and people had to jump, and that's where they really got hurt.
Kevin McGran, we appreciate your updating us from today's news conference. Thank you very much. Kevin McGran covers transportation for the Toronto Star. He joined us from Pearson International there in Toronto in Canada. When we come back from a short break, today on the TOTN Movie Awards, Best Teen Movies Ever. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.